talked to him an hour and a half ago. He's around.
Okay, so. All right. Well, you know, it seems like at the beginning of every chapter, there's a lot of words before we get to any actual math. And this one's no different. So, the last chapter was basically, you know, the Schwarzschild solution and getting into the beginning of black holes. And so chapter 6 is actually more like the implications of black holes. And you get to see all the different types of black holes, and you can get into what happens, you know, where they're spinning or charged or whatever, and what does that play into the full space-time. So this is actually black hole physics here. And from the last time before, we basically said there's only three things you ever need to know about a black hole. Its charge, its spin, and its mass. Nothing else really matters. So one of the characteristics of a black hole is it has what they call event horizon. And so everybody who's listening to science fiction knows this. And the idea is it's essentially if you create a hypersurface, which is basically you take your space-time and you get rid of the time and you just have space, then there's this hypersurface, it's like a spatial thing that separates what's inside the black hole from what's outside. And that's an event horizon. And it's the reason why it's called a horizon is because, you know, you can never really see beyond a horizon. You know, and you look at the old, you know, ships at sea, and they look out and they see the horizon, and they really can't tell what's on the other side. And the same thing here, it's like you see the horizon of the black hole, but you never see beyond it unless you actually go beyond it.
So you have space only and no time component?
Yeah, that's the definition of a hypersurface. And so there is a time-like path that connects inside the black hole to outside, and this horizon is this boundary along this time-like path. And so because there's a time-like path which goes, you know, right parallel to the hypersurface, or perpendicular to hypersurface, then that means that this is a null hypersurface, because a null vector is normal to the hypersurface. And it's kind of like how in geometry we would describe, if we want to talk about the area of this screen, we would draw a vector perpendicular to that, and that vector would represent the screen. And so it's the same thing here, where we're just saying that the horizon as a hypersurface is defined by the vector that's normal to it. And so when we talk about hypersurfaces, we're going to use sigma, this capital sigma here. And f of x is going to be a function on the hypersurface, where x represents the different coordinates. The gradient of this function is really a gradient normal to the hypersurface. And these coordinates, parameterized by lambda, are going to be null geodesics, which are basically, you know, the path that light would take. And so we could think of these as generators of the hypersurface, because the path that the light takes is going to define what is the hypersurface and what is the event horizon, because in order to get to the event horizon, that's the point where light can't escape. And then we have the script E vector, which is a vector which is tangent to the geodesics, which means that there are normal vectors to the hypersurface. And so
normal meaning perpendicular?
Yeah, normal is in perpendicular. But I mean, here we're talking about normal to the hypersurface really means time. So it's kind of like perpendicular, but not really. And so you can think of, since these coordinates, x, are null geodesics, and this other script E is tangent to the geodesics, you can think of, if you take a derivative of this with respect to lambda, then you get something tangent to that. And it's kind of like where this math comes from is, if you think of a a 4 vector like this. This 4 vector is equal to the coordinate, let's say, with respect to tau. And what happens is if you take the 4 vector and you contract it with itself, you get minus 1 by definition. And so if we take the derivative of this, of let me do a time-like derivative. So we're going to take a derivative with respect to tau of this combination of the 4 vectors. Then that's the same thing as taking the derivative of minus 1, which is equal to 0. But according to the chain rule, this is the same thing as taking du d tau, contracting it with u, plus the other du d tau with the other one. And so what happens is we can interpret this as saying that when we take this derivative, where really these two are orthogonal to each other. So acceleration is orthogonal to, or 4 acceleration is orthogonal to 4 velocity and so on. So I mean that's one way of looking at it. And so we could say therefore you can say that this is orthogonal to this. And so that's why we say that if we want the tangent of this vector, we take its derivative. And so we're going to define that as basically, since this derivative of f is a gradient normal to the hypersurface, and this tangent vector here is also a normal vector to the hypersurface, then you can relate the two of them. And all we did was throw in a metric term to raise the indice here. And we threw in a function h because these aren't exactly the same, and it kind of relates how this geodesics might be parameterized. Okay. Now, two other things to note. One is that this tangent to the geodesics, those are null vectors. And if you take two null vectors and you contract them with each other, take the dot product of those two, you're going to get 0 from the definition of a null vector. And also, these are supposed to be geodesic, so they follow the geodesic equation, which means that this holds too. And so we can do things with this, like here, I say, if the hypersurfaces are null at a fixed radius, RH, which is the event horizon boundary, then if you take these two one forms, which are going to basically be normal to the hypersurface, and you can see what we've done is R is parallel to the hypersurface, so we take the one forms and you get something perpendicular to that. And then you contract them using the metric and the value of the metric at that hypersurface, then the result is going to be 0. And since neither one of these independently has to be equal to 0, then that implies that this metric term at the hypersurface and the RR component must be equal to 0. And so what that means is, I know that's a little abstract way of looking at it, but what that means for us is that at the event horizon, GRR goes to 0. And so on one side of the event horizon, GRR is positive. On the other side, it's negative. And time also switches. And it goes from positive to negative. And so this is sort of part of the definition of the event horizon is, you know, where time and space change partners. All right, the next definition we have is called a trap surface. And a trap surface is a Basically, it's a two-dimensional sub-manifold. It's got to be space-like. And the outgoing future-directed light rays are going to converge in both directions on the sub-manifold. So it basically what it is like whenever you have a star and it collapses into a black hole, a trapped manifold is, or a trapped surface is essentially the how you know you've reached a point of no return or a collapse. And so if you think about this, what this means is you have an outgoing future-directed light rays and they converge. And no matter how they go through the submanifold, they're always going to converge. And 2D, the reason why it's 2D is because if you think about it, you get rid of the radius and you just have these angular coordinates. And so it's like light hits these angular coordinates on this sphere and they always converge and become trapped. And that's why they call it a trapped surface. And the singularity theorems basically say that once a collapse reaches a certain point, it's inevitably going to become a singularity. And so they give the example here where if you have a manifold, M, with a generic metric, and it satisfies Einstein's equations with the strong energy condition imposed, then you're going to have a trapped surface in the manifold. And when there's a trapped surface, all the light rays are going to converge on one point. And so either you have a closed time-like curve, which means that time can literally run backwards, or the light cone tips over and you can actually go back to the past, or you've got a singularity where everything converges at a singularity. And the way to think about this TURF time-like curve was from earlier on in the book. I want to say it was in chapter 2 or 3. Oh yeah, here it is, in chapter 2. This is the good picture of on page 81, where you can see this is the definition of closed time-like curve, where literally you're in a hypersurface and the light cones are tilted so that eventually they go around and back in on each other. Okay. Now, when they say a generic metric, what that means is the curvature can't consistently vanish in any direction. And so they're saying that when you look at any of the solutions to Einstein's equations that we might know of, especially like the Schwarzschild solution, you calculate the curvature, and the curvature doesn't just suddenly disappear in a specific direction. It just, if you have to get far away from it, then it'll disappear. But you're not dealing with some strange metric there. And so what you get from this is that there's a lot of general relativity solutions where you're going to end up with some kind of singularity. Now, another thing you guys may have heard of before, it's called cosmic censorship, appropriately named. And the idea here is that you can't get naked singularities from gravitational collapse. If you have a generic, initially non-singular state in an asymptotically flat space-time obeying the dominant energy condition. So what that means is that a naked singularity is basically a singularity where you don't have a horizon around it. And so anytime you have a star collapse into a black hole, it's always going to form this horizon. And that horizon is, like a trapped surface and then a horizon where you know that there's something inside of there going on, but you can't see it. A naked singularity would be as if you could just have this singularity in space-time, just this kind of inconsistent point of infinite curvature where the space-time just doesn't work, and there's nothing around it. And
so, you wouldn't see it? You wouldn't know it was there?
Yeah, you wouldn't know it was there. I mean, it might distort some light around it, but it wouldn't be... there wouldn't be any kind of horizon, so time wouldn't be distorted around it or anything like that. It would just be everything is fine, and then all of a sudden there's a singularity.
You're saying that can't happen?
That it can't happen, according to the cosmic censorship principle. Because the thing about it is, if it could happen, then it would... Well, one thing about it is, it would be like, you know, if you... have a balloon that's completely inflated, and then you look at the balloon and all of a sudden you notice there's a hole in it, but the air hasn't gone out. And it doesn't quite make sense because, you know, if you have this singularity in your space-time, then it should be affecting all the space-time around it. And what a naked singularity implies is that you just have a singularity by itself and all the space-time around it is fine. Because it doesn't gradually go into a horizon or anything. And it sort of violates the idea where the manifold has to be smooth, if that's the case. Plus, I mean, they could be real road hazards. You can imagine walking along and then there's a singularity.
That's when I lose things.
Yeah, they do might exist inside of dryers. But other than that, as far as we know, they don't exist. And so Stephen Hawking, one of his great contributions to this was the area theorem, where he was able to essentially look at these black holes and say that according to the weak energy condition and cosmic censorship, the area of a future event horizon of an asymptotically flat space-time is not going to get any smaller. And so what that means is, if you look at having a asymptotically flat space-time, so things as you go out to infinity, it flattens out. And if you look at the area of the event horizon around a space-time that does that, it's going to essentially stay the same, and it's not going to get any smaller.
That area, would that be the surface area of a hypersurface at the event horizon?
Right. So it would be the area of the hypersurface. And so when you want to do something like say that the area is changing of it or something like that, like a evaporating black hole or something like that, there has to be something else going on here. But this is just basically the principle if you're just talking about a black hole, and that's one reason why it's static. It almost goes without saying that, you know, you would expect the area not to decrease because, if you think about it, how could it decrease? And that kind of violates the idea that you have a time-like killing vector.
And so, what would it decrease to? A naked singularity?
Yeah, I guess the event horizon could just get smaller and smaller and smaller. And, you know, which, who knows, maybe just leak into another dimension. But, I mean, you have to kind of bring in some other physics in order to do that. But if you just use cosmic censorship and the weak condition, then that should be true. Because if you think about it, the cosmic censorship, if you allow these horizons to decrease, eventually you'll get to the point where the singularity could be exposed, which shouldn't happen. And
everything would be decreased around, just leaving that singularity still.
Right.
Event horizon collapse happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the weak energy condition, basically,
I
think the weak energy condition was the one where, let's see, it was the one here which basically said about pressure and density. And so essentially you always ended up having this positive mass density. And pressure could be negative, but the density is kind of always outweighing it. And so if you look at this, there's really nothing that could make it, you know, go negative. I mean, if you could have negative energy, you know, like this, or like this, then maybe you can, you know, start canceling out a black hole. But you'd have to violate the weak energy condition in order to do that. Okay. And so this brings us to killing horizons. And so the idea here is that if you have a killing vector field and it's null along the null hypersurface, then you can call that hypersurface a killing horizon of that vector. And so since if you go back to what we said at the beginning, we pretty much said that this hypersurface that we have has these null vectors tangent to the surface that are the geodesics. And so what that means is that every event horizon in an asymptotically flat space-time is going to be a killing horizon. It has to be stationary and asymptotically flat. If it's not stationary, if it's moving, then all of a sudden the time-like vector isn't just pointing forward in time. And if the space-time is static, then this killing vector is going to be time-like. So it's going to be a time-like killing vector field. And if it's stationary, but it's not static, it'll be axiosymmetric. And so stationary but not static, an example of that is it's rotating. And so you can imagine if it's rotating, then you have a killing vector field that's rotational, like say along the phi direction. And so you can kind of combine this time-like vector, this is point forward in time, with this rotating vector for the angular velocity, and get a new vector which is null, and that is a killing vector is a combination of those two. And so then you still have a killing horizon. And so this is what would describe a spinning black hole.
What's the capital R?
R here, vector. Killing R, capital is the killing vector that's rotational.
Okay.
R for rotational. I don't know how K relates to time. That's just what they use.
I have a question.
Yeah.
To go back and put in English those three bullets,
mm-hmm.
The bottom one's for a spinning black hole. What's the first and the second one called?
The first one would be just a stationary, boring black hole.
A regular one.
Yeah.
Regular.
Mm-hmm. Actually, both of these two. A static. Well, this would be stationary, and this is static. So if you think of both of these together, it basically means a regular old, bored black hole.
Does static mean constant in time?
Static means constant in time. Stationary means that it's not moving physically, like it's not rotating, it's not crashing into another black hole. It's not.
This last one was rotating.
Yeah.
So the stationary one is not rotating, but it's moving directionally in R?
Yeah, no, it could be rotating. Stationary can be rotating.
Oh, I thought you said not rotating.
No, static is not. Static means changing in time. Stationary means it's not moving anywhere. It's not rotating and it's not moving. But if you have it, I'm sorry, confusing
it's
you.
It's not translating.
Stationary is not translating, so it can be rotating.
Okay, so it could rotate and not translate.
Right.
And static is, it's just frozen. It's not rotating and it's not translating.
Right. And one thing you'll see is for the black hole solutions, there's really not much attention paid to a black hole that's not either rotating or moving in some direction. Because they're kind of boring. I mean, if you think about it, it just sits there. If you wanted to study something that just sit there, we would be doing geology right now.
So.
Wait, so mostly it's just only stationary and rotating ones that are looked at?
No, it's mostly, stationary would only be looked at if you're looking at really fundamental physics, if it's stationary and static. And there were things that people have done with, like, isolated horizons and things like that. But if you're talking about most of the black holes that we're going to be reading about and that people are doing research with, they're mostly moving or spinning or something like that. Because if they're moving, they could be colliding, and that's interesting from a source of gravitational waves. If they are spinning, then there's some interesting dynamics going on there. And if you think about it, pretty much every star we've ever seen is spinning. And if stars collapse into black holes, then why do we expect the black hole to not be spinning? So it kind of goes without saying that if you're talking about the real world, you have to make your black hole spin. It can't just be sitting there. And also a lot of, most stars have magnetic fields, so you'd also want to put in magnetic fields on your black holes, too.
So a static one's not translating.
Right.
And it's not rotating.
It can be
stationary,
but not static. Yeah. Yeah, so static means it would not be rotating or translating.
It's the most frozen one, right?
Mm-hmm. So static basically means it's not changing in time.
All right, so we've got static, not rotate, or not translate. Stationary is not translate. And rotate is...
It's stationary but not static.
It is spinning only, rotating only.
Right, because it's not translating, but it is changing in time because it's physically moving around. Okay? Okay, now one other thing we want to define is surface gravity. And this is a property of the Killing Horizon. And what surface gravity does, let's see if I can get their definition here, is it's just a quantity that describes how curved the space-time is, in a way. So in other words, a very big surface gravity is kind of like when you have two geodesics which are more perpendicular to each other. Let me just illustrate here. So if you have a Killing Horizon, then you solve this geodesic equation and you get something which is like the surface gravity times this other vector. And so what happens then is if you use the Killing's equation here and then you use this other equation, which comes from, I think the other one comes from the geodesic equation. Oh, no, this last one comes from the fact that your chi, this vector is normal to the hypersurface. So what happens is you end up saying that if you take the gradient of that and you anti-commute all this stuff, it should give you zero. So this is the Killing's equation, and this comes from the fact it's normal to the hypersurface. Then it's possible to define what this kappa is that makes this work. And this kappa is the surface gravity, which is going to be defined like this. And so it just comes from the gradients of this kappa.
Is that a plus sign? That's an and or a plus sign?
And.
So it's two different equations.
Yeah, these are two different equations.
Two different equations. It's
yeah, this is the Killing's equation, and this comes from the fact that this Killing vector is perpendicular to the hypersurface.
Orthogonal.
Yeah. Well,
orthogonal.
Or, and so what happens is you use both of these, and you can use it to figure out what the kappa is in this equation. And so that this kappa squared is essentially equal to this. And if you normalize the time translational killing vector, K, be equal to the second derivative, or the derivative of with respect to time, then what happens is if you take the two killing vectors, since these are both time-like vectors, contract them with each other, as r goes to infinity, you get minus 1. And so you use this to sort of normalize what the surface gravity is. And what this does is it fixes the surface gravity of an associated killing vector, killing horizon. And since any thing you're going to do this with is asymptotically flat, this is a perfectly valid way of normalizing. And so what they say from this is that if you have this static, asymptotically flat space-time, and static also means that you're going to have this killing vector, which is going to be here, since nothing's changing in the timeline direction, then the surface gravity is essentially going to be the acceleration of a static observer at infinity, near the horizon, as measured by a static observer at infinity. So the surface gravity in this case looks a lot like your acceleration, because this is a derivative of this killing vector. And so if you look at this time translational killing field, where here they've taken the four velocity of the static observer and they've multiplied it by what's actually here, like the magnitude of the killing vectors together. And so you can see that this would just go to, v would go to 1 as you go out to infinity. But then as you get closer and closer in to the horizon, it's going to be different. And so v, as you get close enough in, at the killing horizon, V is going to drop all the way to 0. In which case, K then would disappear as you go in. It's like it would accelerate less and less as you got, you know, your time translational killing field is going to get smaller and smaller as you get in. And you can almost think of V as like a redshift factor, since you have this sort of gravitational redshift. And so the energy of this particle that's falling in, you can think of it as being a contraction of the four momentum and the killing vector. And this, again, is a static black hole. And the frequency of, you know, you can think of it as frequency of the emitted radiation from it, or frequency of light that's shining from the source, is going to be like, go like the four momentum contracted with the four velocity of this distant observer. And so you combine all this together and you can actually get that the frequency is equal to the energy divided by the redshift factor. And the wavelength is just 2 pi over frequency. And so what happens then is that the wavelength, if you have two different observers, one's closer to the black hole than the other one, the wavelength observed by one observer is going to be different than it's emitted from the other one. And this is sort of like your redshift of things falling into a black hole. And you can also see that the acceleration, A, is basically comes from taking this term, which looks a lot like our geodesic equation. And you can see the acceleration here when you contract the two of these. Both of these are like the gradients of the redshift factor, with the minus being on here. And then as you go to the killing horizon, it just basically goes to infinity. In other words, it would take an infinite acceleration to stay static, to keep an object in the same place and a static trajectory when you get into this, as you're passing the event horizon. So if you think about it, that basically means that as you keep falling in, the black hole is going to cause you to accelerate more and more And to counter that acceleration, you're going to have to accelerate in the opposite direction. And so eventually you'll reach a point where you get to the horizon, you need an infinite amount of acceleration just to not fall in. And also you'll notice that kappa is equal to V times A, which is equal to just this part in the radical. And so the surface gravity, again, is just equal to, goes back to this redshift factor. And you can see the surface gravity is written here. And so if you're an observer at infinity, you're going to detect the acceleration to be redshifted by some factor. So it's almost like you say everything gets redshifted. And so the further in, so even though if you're out at infinity, this thing may think they're really accelerating really hard to keep from falling in, and what you see is no acceleration at all because it's been redshifted away. And in the stationary limit surface, we have this thing called an ergosphere, where that's where the two killing vectors contracted together to give you zero. And inside that, the killing vector becomes stationary, becomes space-like, and your observer can't remain stationary. And so this is sort of the, that's why they call it the stationary limit surface, because that's when you reach the surface where you can no longer even think about remaining stationary. And so this is, there's actually an area between the event horizon and when you can no longer remain stationary, and that is the ergosphere. And so what happens in this ergosphere is that the black hole, if it's rotating, it'll actually pull the space-time with it, and we get what we call frame dragging. This is one of the things that Gravity Probe B was sent to look for when it first launched in the 60s. And so you could see what happened here was we started off talking about static black holes, or just a basic static black hole. And so in a static black hole, there is no ergosphere, and this is happening at the event horizon. But when you have a spinning black hole, then all of a sudden you can get the point to this point where this goes to zero before you get to the event horizon. And what the event horizon is defined as is that's when that light converges. And so it's like when you get a spinning black hole, you actually get different regions that are actually interesting. Where with a static black hole, there's just this event horizon, and then there's, you know, total doom, and there's really nothing in between.
So if somebody were caught in the ergosphere, they would still get sucked into the black hole?
Yeah, but they'd be pulled out in a long stream, and they get to orbit it first. Yeah, maybe even have your, you know, your feet and your head in the same place.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're in the ergosphere, it's basically that, it's that this area around this space-time is kind of getting dragged with it. And that's what they call frame dragging. So it's a really interesting effect, and it's something which classically from Newtonian physics you would think wouldn't even exist. Because, you know, in Newtonian physics, it's just, there's no reason why a spinning object, you know, is going to, you know, pull you in with it if it's a smooth, perfectly round ball. But here you can have a perfectly round, smooth ball, like say the sun, and if it's perfect, then if the Earth was near it, there's no reason the Earth should have to spin with it unless the Earth was already spinning with it when it formed. Here it says even if let's say an object were to enter the solar system with no angular velocity with the solar system whatsoever, the frame dragging from the star would actually eventually cause it to spin. Okay. Now, back to a Schwarzschild black hole. We have our Schwarzschild metric here, and we have the killing vector, which is just time-like, purely time-like. And we have the four velocity, which goes like this first term to the minus one-half power. And V is going to be equal to 1 minus 2gm over R. And you could see that from essentially here, where you take K and its inverse and you multiply them together, etc. And so you can do the math and see that when you do the inverse of this, that has to happen. So once you have V, you can calculate the acceleration, and you get the acceleration looks like this, and you have this gradient of R. And, you know, we know what R is. And so when you take the derivatives of that with respect to all the different coordinates, you see that mu equals R, and you just have a radial acceleration, which is going to give you this. And so this is the acceleration, and then you can calculate the surface gravity by combining these two terms. And you see the surface gravity ends up just being gm over R squared, which is exactly what you would expect from Newton. And so if you take this a step further, at the event horizon, the surface R equals 2gm, the surface gravity is just going to be 1 over 4gm. And you can see that as you increase the mass, the Schwarzschild radius increases. And when the Schwarzschild radius increases, the surface gravity is going to decrease.
K was started out as a killing vector and ended up just as a scalar,
mm-hmm.
as surface gravity?
No.
That's kappa.
Oh, that's kappa.
Yeah, that's kappa, the killing...
just on the top line on the screen is the killing vector.
Yeah, this is kappa from here. And so this killing... this kappa tells you surface gravity. And so it's really interesting. So what happens is it's saying that if you were to take a star and you keep the mass the same, but you blow up the star, like when a star is going to die, there's less surface gravity, which is kind of like what you'd expect because you're further away from the center of mass. And even for a black hole, as a black hole... Unless you also, if you increase the mass of the black hole, then its surface gravity would actually decrease, which is kind of weird. But that's also because you increase the mass and the radius also, Schwarzschild radius also gets bigger, and therefore everything kind of decreases.
Have a lower mass density.
Mm-hmm. And this also makes sense, too, because... If you think about it, the whole reason why we have the gravity in the first place comes from curvature. And so as you increase the radius, you're decreasing the curvature. And as you decrease the curvature, you're decreasing the gravity. That all makes sense. Okay. All right. So any questions on this before we move on to charge? So, I mean, that's all the basic stuff about black holes that would work, especially for a Schwarzschild solution. Now we're going to move on to a more advanced solution. And, there's two other black holes you usually hear about. One's called Kerr and one's called Newman. And then there's the Kerr shield and the Newman, or Kerr-Newman and all that. But the basic idea is we want to be able to talk about charge of a black hole and not just its... And not just its mass. And so, and the thing about this is that if you can imagine, if you're a charged particle and you're headed towards a black hole, gravitationally this thing is sucking you in, but electromagnetically you might be repelled from it. So what happens? Well, electric force is actually stronger than gravitational force, so you actually can get a standoff and you can get some interesting things. And also, one other thing we'll see is that when you have a black hole and it's spinning, well, what happens if a star is spinning really, really fast? Can it still collapse into a black hole? It actually would have to shed off some of that angular momentum before it can. So, for electric charge, you've got Maxwell's equation here, where you've got the divergence of F, and this is the electric forecurrent. So you see the sub E here.
That's what that is.
Yeah. That should be an E. And so what happens is that you can actually calculate the charge density by just integrating this electric forecurrent over a hypersurface. In other words, you integrate it over a volume. And then what this here means is that you're actually have a vector normal to that hypersurface, which is a time-like vector. And so that ends up giving you what we think about as usually charge density, or charge. And so instead of doing this, we can replace this charge density term, or electric forecurrent density, with the left-hand side of Maxwell's equation. And so this is the electric charge in terms of the electromagnetic field tensor. And so you can, and you have this normal pointing vector, and you also have this divergence term. And so they can eliminate the divergence using Stokes' theorem and get something like this, where you can see here you're integrating over a hypersurface, and here you're integrating over a lower dimensional hypersurface. And so you can see here, this was a three-dimensional metric, and now this is only a two-dimensional metric. And so this is the time-like normal to the hypersurface, and then this is some other dimension, like say this is radial. And so we're integrating over the whole surface area. So, like I said, sigma is an outward-pointing normal vector or a radial vector, another way of saying that. And so for your magnetic charge, you would do the same thing, but you'll take the dual of F. And so when you do that, you can get the electric charge and a magnetic charge of your black hole. And you can also translate, instead of, you can also do dipoles and quadrupoles and whatever other poles. And of course, you know, your magnetic charge is going to end up being a dipole for a black hole. So, therefore, if we know that the electromagnetic field at spatial infinity, then we know the total charge of a black hole. Because, after all, we have kind of like a Gauss's law thing going on. And so, the field has to go somewhere. And so, as long as we know the field at infinity, we can see what the charge of the hole is. And here's the neat thing about this. This is kind of one of those things where, you know, you have to really interpret Einstein's rules correctly. But Einstein's rules basically say you can't get energy, like light cannot leave the event horizon of black hole. Once it goes in, it's stuck. However, electromagnetic fields don't carry information. They're not like light. They're basically just fields. So they can exist through the horizon without any problem. And so you can have these charges frozen into a black hole. And supposedly you can also freeze a magnetic field in as well. And so you can do things with this where you can take this into account as part of your black hole. So, like, let's say you want to calculate the energy current. The energy current here, or mass current, is given by essentially taking the stress energy tensor and contracting it with your Killing vector. And so the energy is going to be given by just this integral, same way you would do with charge. Since this equation looks a lot like what we did here for charge, or for current density. It's just a different kind of current. And so we just replace that with the right-hand side of the equation. And then you see for Schwarzschild, this is going to give you zero because the stress energy tensor is zero for Schwarzschild, for vacuum. But you can replace that T with something else and make it work. Now, the one thing is, naively you would say that this is true because you're in a vacuum and T is equal to zero, so everything disappears. But what this is saying then is that you don't have any energy in this black hole, which can't be right. Because after all, these are powerful, massive things. It can't have no energy. So what they've done is, again, you can try looking at the energy flow as being the pointing vector, but here you're going to replace the stress tensor here with the Ricci tensor. And when you do that, now you've got two terms over here for the stress tensor and its contracted stress tensor. And then if you take the divergence of this current, then this first part is going to give you zero because since this is a killing vector, it's going to be anti-symmetric by definition. And the Ricci we know is symmetric, and every time you contract an anti-symmetric with a symmetric tensor, you get zero. For this other part, now you've got the divergence of the Riemann, or sorry, the divergence of the Ricci, and you can use this property to replace that with a Riemann, not a Ricci scalar, sorry. And what that tells us then is the current, if you take the divergence of the current, then you got the gradient of the Ricci, and then you're contracting that with the killing vector, but you can see that this is like saying that you're taking a derivative of the Ricci scalar along the direction of the killing vector. And by definition, that should be equal to zero because nothing changes with the metric or the curvature along the killing vector. And so the divergence part works, which is sort of like you would expect it to work. Like it would work here because you could see that, you know, divergence of the current should be equal to zero. And so therefore, the energy can come from integrating that. And when you integrate it, you can replace this killing vector contracted with the Riemann with this second two derivatives of the killing vector. This comes from earlier in the book. And so you can rewrite this current in terms of the killing vector, as opposed to before, where we had the current in terms of the Ricci. And so anyway, you can see direct correlation between these two. And so when you do that, you've now got divergences and gradients inside of your integral. And you can use Stokes' theorem here again, get it integrated over just the surface of the black hole. And now you have this term here, which is the derivative of the killing vector. And this is known as the Komar integral. And so what happens is you can solve this and you can get the energy of the mass the same way you would get the total charge of the black hole. This way you get the mass. Otherwise, you get something that says that the energy of this black hole goes to zero, which doesn't make any sense. Now, for Schwarzschild, what happens is if you take these n terms, this is the time-like normal, where the black hole is not spinning or anything, you get minus one. And you take these two, which is like the R vector, and you get plus one. And so N0 comes directly from the metric, and it should be equal to this. Sigma 1 comes directly from the metric, and it should give you this. So in other words, these are like taking the square root of the relative metric terms. And so when you take these two, and you contract them with the derivative of the Killing vector, then you contract like elements, you can see that this has to be 0, so this has to be 0. This has to be 1, so this has to be 1. So you just have minus the time derivative of the one term of the Killing vector. And since k mu is equal to 1,0,0,0, then...
Does that mean k1 equals 0?
No. What that means is that you can take this del 0 k1 and think of it as having the metric times this derivative. So this is like taking the partial derivative, you know, a total covariant derivative here. And so the partial derivative of k1 is equal to 0 because there's no term here. But this other term with the Christoffelson was not. And so this thing, we're saved here by the fact that we're not just talking about partial derivatives. And so when you look at this, these two terms have to be the same. And so this term has to be equal to 0 because that's the only non-zero term. So this term has to be 0. So we're looking for the 1,0,0 Christoffelson term. And so you find that, and you put it in, and you get this. So it's the 1,0,0 Christoffelson term for the Schwarzschild metric. And so you can see we've gone through, this is the 0,0 term here. And then this is the Christoffelson term. The K0 term is just 1. And then these two cancel each other out, and you just get it minus GM over R squared. And so when you, we're going to take this a little bit further, and you can see that when you take the metric terms, you also, in order to do this integral here, so we have this part figured out. Now we've got to take this determinant of this metric. And so we're just dealing here with the angular terms. So we've got the theta metric term and the phi metric term. And so we take the determinant of that and we just get r squared sine theta. And so we're just integrating d theta d phi r squared sine theta with the gm over r squared. And we're dividing by 4 pi g. And so when we do this integral, we end up with m, which is exactly what we wanted, that it's basically saying that the energy of this black hole is equal to this mass that's inside of it. And so this is the way they put it is the total energy can be defined using the generator of the time translations in an asymptotically flat space-time. Okay. All right, now one last thing today before I let you guys go. And this is talking about the ADM energy. And ADM comes up a lot. These are three guys, Arnwit, Diesner, and Messner. And the idea here is that if you take the metric and you write it as flat space plus a perturbation, and this perturbation is thought to be pretty small, so it's called linearized space-time, which we'll talk about next week. And then what happens is you can take this energy that we just calculated and you can write it instead in terms of perturbed space-time. And when you write it in terms of perturbed space-time, you get something like this, where these derivative terms here take the place of what's going on with this killing vector. And so, I'm not going to bore you with everything to go through for that, but the idea is then that if the perturbation is time-independent at infinity, then you get the same solution for the ADM energy and the energy using the Ricci, or the curvature energy, however you want to think about it. And so what this is useful for is it captures the energy of the of gravitational waves as well, and not just the energy of, say, a black hole. And so the way they explain this in the book is they say the ADM energy of a non-singular asymptotically flat space-time obeying Einstein's equations and the dominant energy condition is non-negative. Furthermore, Minkowski is the only such space-time with vanishing ADM energy. So in other words, the only way to have zero energy is to have a perfectly flat space-time. If you have any energy at all, the space-time is going to have some curvature to it. And so even like when we start looking at systems with just gravitational waves, there's going to be some energy there. And angular momentum is another thing we're going to talk about. Angular momentum is, or spin, basically comes from having a rotating killing vector. And so we're going to do the same thing we just did, but you put a rotating killing vector in as opposed to a time-like killing vector, and you still use a Ricci. And then what we end up with is this equation right here at the top, which is basically current from or angular momentum current, and then you just integrate this whole thing. And here is the rotational killing vector. And so as you can see, we stop here. And so what we're going to do next time is we're going to talk about charged black holes, which are the Reisner-Nordström. And then we're going to go into some of the other interesting things that could come up with different types of black holes. All right. Any questions?
Oh, yeah, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is a regular black hole up here. Rotates and it translates?
Well, that's when you would actually physically see.
Static case would be lower right hand.
Yeah. Static would be down here where it doesn't rotate and it doesn't translate.
Got that. Okay.
Okay.
And then over here, I got two of them. Over here, I got stationary and...
Rotates, but it doesn't translate.
Yeah, that's stationary. Right?
Yeah, that could be stationary. That could be stationary.
And it can
but
also...
But it's not static. See, this would be stationary and static. If it's not rotating and it's not translating, then you could say it's stationary and static.
Which they don't have a name for that.
Well, they do. It's stationary and static.
Okay. Oh, okay. So that's it.
So, I mean, and also what static also assumes is it's not doing anything weird, like it's not pulsating and it's not evaporating and stuff isn't falling in and making it bigger. It's staying the way it is.
And so here we have a stationary and we also have rotating over in that box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not translating, but it's rotating.
But a stationary one is, I mean, these two are different apparently.
Yeah. It's a difference between if I say If that's moving, that's not stationary.
It's true, it's not stationary.
Right. But what if it's here, it's not moving, but it's spinning?
Well, then I'd put it here. I'd put that one here, and I'd put this one up here.
Right. And so what happens in the real world, especially if you're talking about, say, solar mass black holes, is they're in a galaxy, and they are spinning around the center of the galaxy. And as they're spinning around the center of the galaxy, they're translating. But they're also probably spinning if they're from collapsed stars. And they're also, if they have a companion star and they're gobbling up stuff, you know, gobbling up mass from the other star, then it's also adding mass to it, which means it's not static either. So what we're doing is, we say stationary and static, we're using a very ideal case about a black hole which exists by itself, alone in the universe. It's not moving, it's not spinning, it's not doing anything. If you can understand that, then you can move on to the next one.
And it might, we don't know if they exist or not. We haven't found any yet, right?
We don't get to really see black holes up close that much anyway.
Okay.
I mean, most of the black holes we see, the reason why we even know they're there is because they're gobbling up another star, a companion star. So even if they weren't spinning, they would still not really be static, if that's the case. But if they, I'm talking about black holes at the center of galaxies, they're always gobbling up other stars, and they're spinning. And the rest of the solar system, or the galaxies, kind of spinning around them. And a lot of them have active galactic nuclei, where their stuff is coming in and picking up a lot of angular momentum and getting shot out as jets. In which case, that's definitely a lot of stuff going on.
And why does the theory not have anybody up there in this box?
Well, because we just haven't talked about it. It's basically like, if you have a black hole and it's not rotating, but it's moving, that's what we use sometimes if we're talking about black hole collisions. But the thing is, it's really, when you're talking about translating black holes that are not spinning, the one thing that's good for is studying a source of gravitational waves, which we haven't even gotten to yet. As far as the black hole itself, it's really, it's a lot of complicated math without actually telling you much. Best way to put it. Because what's happening is, when you have a black hole, and as soon as you have that black hole moving through space-time, it's going to cause ripples in that space-time to go out. And it's kind of like you have a big ship and it's moving through the water. If you want to understand what's going on there, you have to use the gravitational waves. As far as what's happening to the black hole itself, it's really not changing any of the physics of the black hole itself much beyond this ideal case.
Excuse me.
Especially if it's not moving too fast. So that's why we haven't studied that. But, you know, if you want to use it for a numerical study to, you know, collide black holes, it's easy if they're not spinning, and you can do that. As soon as you start your black hole spinning and you're trying to do a computer simulation, it's a hard enough problem anyway, and it just gets harder.
But realistically, most black holes would be spinning anyway.
Yeah, realistically. Most of them would be spinning. Most of them will be moving in some way. Most of them will have some kind of magnetic field or charge. And most of them, if you're even going to notice they're there, are going to have some kind of companion.
Probably have changing mass.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like a crawl before you can walk thing, where we're just looking at the simplest cases, and if you can get some knowledge out of that, then it works. And also, one reason why we don't jump into something like that is because the solution also isn't very difficult. Think about all the math that it went through to solve the Schwarzschild solution for a single black hole, which is not moving, not spinning, not charged. Now imagine you have two spinning charged black holes slamming into each other. And somebody write out the equations analytically to describe that.
So that's a good thing. Schwarzschild goes in the lower right.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else's names go anywhere up there?
There's a Kerr black hole.
Where does it go?
That's the rotating.
That's the K-U-R?
K-E-R.
R.
Yeah.
And why did they differentiate between stationary and rotating?
Because it's different.
Because
one thing is the killing vector would be different. Because the killing vector is in the direction that the thing is not changing. And so if it's rotating, it has a rotational killing vector, which is going, like, say, in the phi direction. If it's translating, and let's say it's moving along the x direction, then it'll have a killing vector in that direction. And so if you change the killing vector, you're changing a lot of the stuff we went through today.
But if it's stationary, it's not translating, and if it's rotating, it's not translating.
Right, and that's when you just have a simple time-like killing vector, which is why we just use that. But, yeah, your killing vector gets a lot more complicated if you start having spinning or translating black holes. Your solution to Einstein's equation gets more complicated because you got to remember, you'll see this when we do the Kerr black hole, but like I said before, when a black hole is spinning and you have that ergosphere, you're not just spinning a black hole, you're spinning the space-time around the black hole. And so it's not just the same thing as taking a fixed black hole solution and then just spinning it around. You know, it's like you're literally pulling your coordinate system with it. And your geodesics in a spinning black hole are not going to look the same as they are for a static black hole or stationary. So, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, mentally, if you look at, you know, you just picture a ball, and you picture a ball moving versus spinning around on a table, or it doesn't seem like it's much difference, but the mathematics gets a lot more complicated.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. And by the way, that problem I mentioned with, you know, if you had two black holes like this, even just two black holes that aren't spinning, all of a sudden your space-time kind of looks like this, right? This, nobody's even solved. No. I mean, nobody has solved this analytically. I should say. Numerically, you can come up with a reasonable solution for what the initial conditions on this looks like. But analytically, you can't solve it. And then you start these things spinning, and you start slamming them into each other, and then you make one of them with a bigger mass than the other.
And different charge.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't mean you put it in charge here. But, you know, you get the idea. And this is what we do in numerical relativity, where you actually have to come up with the initial conditions on this and simulate what happens. And the reason why you simulate it is because you can't work that out by hand as far as what it's going to do, what are the gravitational waves going to look like as the two of them get close to each other. So, yeah. Okay. So I'll see you guys Thursday. One last thing I forgot about. I got to give you the final exam questions. And I already shut down the projector, so I just had to tell them. Well,
might not be too bad. Too far gone.
Well, I'm thinking Chapter 7 and Chapter 8. This is going to be on Chapter 7. There are problems 1, 4, and 7. In Chapter 8, problems 1 and 2. So there should only be 5 problems total. And this is going to be due on August 9th, which is a few days after the last class.
August 9th?
Yeah. So Chapter 7, 147, and Chapter 8, 1 and 2. And all the stuff on these problems, we're hopefully going to, we should cover all of it beforehand. I'm working on the notes for Chapter 7. I should have everything ready long before we meet. But let me just go over some of the problems. The first problem is actually just showing that the Lagrangian gives rise to a linearized version of Einstein's equation. So basically, you're going to construct a linearized version of Einstein's equations, which is actually a lot simpler than some of the stuff you have been doing. And linearized space-time is easier to work with. Another one has to do with gauge conditions. And we'll talk about that next time, or next week, where there's a thing called a Lorentz gauge, which is equivalent to a harmonic gauge, and they're going to use this to show that the coordinate box equals zero. And then the last question is where you have gravitational waves from two free-flying masses, and one of the masses is equipped with a laser and an accurate clock and a good mirror. And the distance between the masses can be measured by timing how long it takes the laser pulse to make a round-trip journey. How would you make a detector your detector orientated to register the largest response from a plane wave of this form? So in other words, you're going to build a gravitational wave detector. And next week, when we go through the chapter, we may not... well, we're probably not going to get to the gravitational wave detection part of this, but it is actually, you know, what I would suggest is, you know, if you read through the rest of Chapter 7 like this, that might give you some hints on that last problem. Problems 1 and 4, you know, you'll pretty much be able to just walk through it. Now, for Chapter 8... just the first two problems. Well, the first problem is you're going to have an n plus one dimensional space-time, which is described by this. And what they want you to do is calculate the Ricci tensor, define the energy momentum tensor in terms of this, and then derive the equations of the energy density and pressures for a static solution. So in other words, you're kind of developing a cosmology based on some of the stuff you're given. And so it's kind of like reproducing what some of the models do. And the other one is actually working with De Sitter space, which is something, it's a good model to know, where they want you to solve this geodesic equation for De Sitter space. And so should be very doable. And so what I'd say suggest is, do some reading on this stuff, and then be ready with questions as we go through it, since we're only going to spend one day on each chapter. And then that way you get a good start. But the Chapter 7 stuff really... if you paid attention to the other stuff we've done in here, it's really not as hard as a lot of the other problems you guys have already done.
And what's the I, X superscript I, not constant?
In Chapter 8?
I have a question, number 2.
Oh. Hold on.
Page 375.
Yeah, I just put the book away.
There you go.
Oh, xi not equal to constant. Basically, what that's saying is that you have two co-moving observers. In other words, the spatial distance between the two observers is not changing.
Oh, my book reads differently.
Well, what does yours say?
It's non-co-moving.
Observers. It says not constant.
That is not constant.
And yours says xi is equal to constant.
Hold on, let me... Yeah, probably he may have changed a couple things.
I just need to understand what it is.
Well, let me double check something here. This is his corrections. Yeah, he says here, in the official guide, problem 2 was completely fumbled. It should be... Yeah, so it should be corrected in your book. So it should be, 2HT... Not HT, and we want Hubble H to be the Hubble parameter, and the co-moving observers are precisely the wrong ones you want to question about. So they should be non-co-moving observers.
Okay. And it looks like David Garfinkel was reading it.
Right here.
Yeah, what they do is they quietly correct these errors without actually putting out another edition.
And so xi is not constant.
Yeah, xi is not constant. That means that the distance between them can change. Which actually, it makes a lot more sense when you do it that way, because otherwise you would think that you shouldn't have two co-moving observers in a de Sitter space.
So co-moving would be like they're moving exactly...
Yeah, it's like almost holding hands, just moving along.
And non-co-moving means they're...
One guy is coming like this, the other is going like that, pulling them apart. Yeah. Because what happens is, in this de Sitter space, this is like an expanding space-time. It's like a cosmological space-time, kind of like what you saw with the... when we looked at putting that scale factor parameter in and space expanded, that's basically what happens here. And so in this expanding space, you would expect that the two observers of the universe would just kind of spread out. Okay. All right. Okay, any other questions? All right, well, let's call it a day then. See you guys.